Today's episode is sponsored by Greenlight. Did you know that 27 states don't require a personal finance course for students, even though teens score an average of 64% on the National Financial Literacy Test? Let's make a difference. Our friends at Million Bazillion and Greenlight are hitting the road, visiting schools to teach important lessons on financial literacy. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live and interactive. Million Bazillion Live is in partnership with Greenlight, the money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That's greenlight.com/million. Your big questions drive brains on, your curiosity shapes each episode, and your support can help make more episodes of the podcast that you love. You can make a tax-deductible year-end gift to Brains On at brainson.org/donate. Whew, we made it to the peak. What a view.
Yeah, all that nature, all those plants and animals. National parks are the best.
Yeah, I could stand here all day staring at it.
Me too. Wait, aren't we supposed to be doing something?
What do you mean? We are doing something. We're taking in this view.
No. We're supposed to be hosting a special series on Brains On right now. It's all about the national parks.
Oh, right. Was that today?
Yeah.
Okay. We gotta go. We're gonna be late. Put the theme song on, and that should buy us a little bit of time while we, like, scoot down this mountain. Okay, let's go.
Keep listening.
Okay, back in the studio. You are listening to Brains On from NPR News and Southern California Public Radio. I'm your host, Molly Bloom.
And I'm Carter Watley.
So Carter, we asked you to co-host this series with us because you have a very special relationship to a national park. What is that?
Yes, I lived 13 years in Yosemite National Park.
And you are 13 right now?
Yeah.
So you just like a few months ago, you just moved kind of right outside the park, right?
Yeah.
So that is an experience that not a lot of people have had. So how is it that you came to live in Yosemite? How is your family there?
My dad worked in the park and we were able to live there.
That's amazing. Can you describe what your house in Yosemite looked like? Was it a tent or was it a house?
It was a house and it was connected to another person's house, but there was a wall in between and you had a meadow in front of you and trees, and then you saw a Half Dome.
What's Half Dome?
Half Dome is one of the biggest mountains in Yosemite National Park.
So you woke up in the morning and looked out and that was just there.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And I know you really enjoy hiking.
Yeah.
How many hikes would you say you've been on in your life? Can you even count?
No, I don't know how many I've been on, but I know I've been on a lot.
And what are some of your favorite hikes?
I like the Vernal Falls Mist Trail because it's you hike up to the top of a waterfall and you can hear the waterfall before you even get there. And as you get closer, you get misted with the water in the springtime.
Because you're like hot from hiking, so that probably feels awesome.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for people who may not have hiked before and they might be interested in starting to hike?
You want to be prepared and ready. Have enough food and water. And you want to know what you're doing. Just like, know if you know what you're doing, you want don't want to like start out fast. You want to start out slow and steady.
So what is your favorite animal in Yosemite?
I like the bear. I think it's just really cool how like it just like walks, roams around and does whatever it wants.
So do you have to like get out of the bear's way? Is it dangerous?
It can be. You just don't want to like get close to any like animal really. You just want to leave it be.
So what kind of stuff does the bear do?
Sometimes it climbs in the trees and like eats the apples. And sometimes it just walks around and just sits there.
So then that's an important part, too, of being in a national park, of sort of enjoying it, but also leaving the nature to be.
Yeah. You want to listen to the sounds of nature and, like, winds in the trees and birds singing. And you will always want to respect nature.
That is very wise. And we hope this series of stories on the national parks helps other people understand the parks like you do. To learn more about national parks, we've got 5 stories on some of the coolest science happening at our national parks.
We'll take you to a desert, to a beach, and to a place where wild horses still roam.
First, let's start with a park in South Dakota. Now, dear listener, what do you think of when we say national park? Probably trees, trails, mountains, lakes, all the great outdoor stuff. But what's underneath it all?
In the case of South Dakota's Wind Cave National Park, a lot. We sent producer Mark Sanchez deep underground for this story.
Caves come in all shapes and sizes. There are caves of limestone with dramatic stalactites dripping from the roof. There are caves in glaciers, swathed in patches of green and blue. There are even caves near volcanoes, in tubes left behind from lava flow. With all this variety, it can be difficult to define just what a cave is. So let's keep it simple.
The main kind of thread amongst them all is that it's naturally forming, you know, versus a mine that is, you know, human created. So it's a natural occurring void in the rock or in the earth.
Mark Ohms is a scientist at Wind Cave National Park in the Black Hills of South Dakota. He's been exploring caves for 30 years. In other words, he's a caver. Above ground, Wind Cave National Park fits in with its surrounding South Dakota landscape. Bison mingle with prairie dogs, ponderosa pine trees sprout up through tall natural grasses. It's truly a beautiful and inspiring sight. When I talked with Mark Ohms, however, we had just stepped off an elevator. We were about 300 feet underground. No vegetation, no animals, just a huge chamber room with walking passages sprouting off in all different directions.
Currently, we have over 146 miles of cave passages mapped. We really don't know the true extent of it because we have, you know, lots of passages we haven't even been in yet. You know, if you look on the map in the visitor center, you'll see all these little things that lead to question marks. You know, and those are exactly that. You know, we don't know. You know, those are question marks. Nobody's been in that one yet.
Come with me for a second to the Himalayas, Mount Everest. At its peak, Mount Everest is a little over 5 miles high. Now think about the 146 miles of caves that have been mapped at Wind Cave. If you were hovering over the cave, it would only be about 1 square mile. Not too impressive. But underground, those 146 miles look like a tightly wound ball of string. Spaghetti-like paths twist back and forth and go as deep as 500 feet below the ground. And not all the paths are walkable. To be a caver means crawling into crevices and getting really dirty. Being nearly stuck in a crack hundreds of feet underground, not such a fun time, if you ask me. But for cavers like Mark, that's just what the job calls for.
About a year ago, we went down into this passage called Shelob's Lair. And there was a tight spot that somebody found way back in the 70s called the Meat Grinder. And I was looking at, you know, the reports, and it's like, well, nobody's been back. And there was question marks back there. And I was like, well, I want to go to those question marks, of course. So we went there and kind of found out why nobody's been back. only one trip went through the Meat Grinder. You know, thanks, because it is, yeah, I bled. You know, I mean, it tore my shirt up. It tore my skin up. It's very tight. You know, it's sub 8 inches. You know, it's probably 7 3/4 inches and stuff for about 200 feet. You know, that it was nasty.
In something like that, you're crawling along a passageway that's fewer than 8 inches high.
Yeah.
And then does it open up? Is there ever a payoff?
Yeah, luckily it opened up on the other side. And then we get to the question marks. We're actually walking passages, you know, so we were quite shocked at it. And we surveyed about 1,000 feet of new passages, and we left 2 question marks of our own that had strong airflow coming out of, so we need to go back.
And then you have to go back through the passage,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's, yeah, it was probably, yeah, I'm still healing on that one, so.
One of the ways cavers try to figure out where to go next is by searching for wind. Think about it. If you were walking above ground near some rocks, say you pass a crack and feel a gust of wind, where is that coming from? That's a good indication that there's a void, an empty space somewhere beneath the ground, a void big enough to hold and move that wind. And that's exactly how the first explorers of Wind Cave figured out it was there. There's a 10-inch hole in the side of a cluster of rocks. This natural cave opening gusts with the unmistakable sound of wind. It can blow up to 30 miles an hour. And it's not just pushing out either. The cave breathes in and out. And it's because of the weather, because of barometric pressure. You see, the cave is so vast, there is so much space, that it has its own air pressure system. Air pressure below the ground is constantly trying to match the atmospheric pressure above ground, commonly known as barometric pressure. When there's a low pressure system above the ground, which usually means cloudy skies and storms, air pressure inside the cave blows out. And when the skies are clear, a good indication of high barometric pressure, the cave takes a big breath in. The land surrounding the Black Hills and Wind Cave has been occupied by the Lakota people for centuries, long before American settlers. Wind at the natural cave opening has been mythologized as a sacred area, which is key to the origin of the Lakota. It was the breathing that lured the first explorers of Wind Cave underground in the late 1800s. Just imagine making your way into this hole in the ground. Nobody had ever been there before. There were no sidewalks or paths, definitely no electricity. The only source of light, a candle. Otherwise, the cave is darker than night. Even with all those barriers, over the years, people continued to explore and map the cave. Maybe one tiny crevice leads to another path and another crevice, which might open up into a new, undiscovered room. Coming up, Mark Ohms goes looking for that next big room, and he's not about to let anything get in his way. Not even a den of rattlesnakes.
We can't do an episode of Brains On without this.
Mystery sound.
It's time for the mystery sound. Here it is. Any guesses?
Maybe a bird or a seagull?
Yeah, it does sound like a bird. We're going to hear it again. And okay. here's a hint. It was recorded near Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. Okay, so that was recorded on the South Dakota prairie. Any new thoughts?
Would it be bats?
Oh, good guess. Here's the answer.
My name is Greg Schrader. I'm the Chief of Resource Management here at Wind Cave National Park. And that sound you just heard was a prairie dog jump yipping.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Prairie dogs are adorable. I saw them for the first time last summer, and they became my new favorite animal. They stand up on their hind legs, and they make those cute little yips. And they actually have a very complicated communication system with those yips. So it's not just for fun.
There's been a lot of research done on what I'll call the language of prairie dogs. And it's a very complex language between normal yips back and forth and communication with each other saying, you know, like either this is my territory, I live over here, don't come in here, you know, or everything's fine, like the all clear sign. But they'll have distinct sounds for a badger that comes into their area, a coyote, an eagle. They'll let out a different size warning call. One of the other things that they do is you'll notice the grass height is always short on a prairie dog colony. That's so they can see their predators and basically warn each other. Once you hear it, you'll hear that call kind of almost echo across the prairie dog colony as they're kind of relaying it to each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Do you have a mystery sound you'd like to share with us?
A question you want answered on the show?
Or maybe you just want to send us a drawing or a high five.
Email us anytime. We're at brainson@minnesotapr.org.
Or you can find our mailing address at our website, brainson.org.
And if you're a fan of the show, please consider leaving a review in iTunes.
It really helps other kids and families find out about the show.
Now's the time in the show when we send high fives to all the kids who fuel the show with their creativity and energy. Here's the most recent group to be added to the Brains Honor Roll. Magnus and Odin from Portland, Oregon, Vivian from Silver Lake, Ohio, Juniper from Seattle, Ciara from Taipei, Taiwan, Josephine and Wesley Clare from Redwood City, California, Julia from Los Angeles, Rosie from Auckland, New Zealand, Edie, Wilder and Mavis from Brooklyn, Decker from San Diego, Stanley and Duncan from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Jacob and Ryan from Wheaton, Illinois, Joey from Cincinnati, Afik from Palo Alto, California, Ian from Fredericksburg, Virginia, Katie from Sydney, Australia, William and Henry from Minneapolis, Marshall from Ithaca, Evan from Berwyn, Pennsylvania, Jack from Renton, Washington, Aaron and Arena from Shutesbury, Massachusetts, Kaylee from Eugene, Oregon, Andrianne from Kitchener, Ontario, Anna from Neenah, Wisconsin, Walter and Archie from Ancaster, Ontario, Kaya from St. Mary's County, Maryland, and Pascal from Riverside, California.
You're listening to a special National Parks edition of Brains On. Today we have our headlamps on to explore the passageways of Wind Cave National Park. Now back to producer Mark Sanchez as he shines a light on some of the newest and oldest discoveries.
If you measure the amount of air that Wind Cave holds and compare that to the 146 miles of passageways and chambers, only 10% of the cave has been discovered. Part of Mark Ohms' job as a physical science technician for the park is to look for new caves. And that's just what he was doing in the spring of 2004.
There's a lot of cave out there to be discovered yet. So thinking, well, rather than necessarily pushing it from Wind Cave side, why not maybe try to find another entrance and come in from, you know, kind of the back door, if you will. So I was out purposely looking for that back door, that other entrance.
Based on the geology of the area, Mark picked a spot to go searching for a hole that moved air, and he found one. But there were a couple problems.
For starters, I couldn't fit. It's too small for human entry. Secondly, it had quite a few rattlesnakes denned up in it. I don't know which one was worse. So I had to wait for the rattlesnakes to leave, and then, you know, we're going to have to dig to enlarge this, you know, and large enough to for we can get into it. So we have, you know, a researcher who looked at that airflow and compared it to Wind Cave, and, you know, the patterns look exactly the same, you know. So we started, you know, removing the dirt. It was just a nice soft dirt floor that we had to remove. And then we started finding bones, and that was a whole nother story. You know, we thought, oh, you know, it's probably just recent stuff, you know, maybe 100 years, you know, something of that nature.
So Mark asks some paleontologists to come check out what he's unearthed, and it turns out it's way older than he guessed.
We're not talking tens of years, we're not talking hundreds of years, we're talking at least 10,000 plus, you know, year old stuff. And we started finding critters that, you know, camels, horses, you know, we're not talking, you know, the horse, you know, cowboy horse that's, you know, around today or anything. We're talking, you know, horses, you know, that are long gone extinct, and camels and bears and, you know, and things that we don't have around here anymore.
Wow.
And then they did some carbon dating. We have a bison that's 35,000 years old. We have a horse that's 38,000 years old. So we're even getting older as we, you know, get down deeper into the dirt. So we're about 200 feet into that now, and we're still digging. We have good airflow coming out, and we're still finding just this has just turned into a treasure trove of bones.
There's a pretty good chance that this cave will be connected at some point to Wind Cave, but it's still too early to tell whether that's going to be the case. But since Mark was the one to find it, he was the one that got to name it. And since he's only been able to get down about 200 feet in the last 12 years, he calls it Persistence Cave.
It's been taking a while to, you know, to get to point A to point B. And I said, you know, just don't give up hope and, you know, be persistent, and that will pay off. You know, this persistence will pay off, and we'll be into the big cave system.
As the excavation continues, the limestone walls of Persistence will most likely share some features of Wind Cave. You may have seen other limestone caves with stalactites dripping from above and stalagmites protruding from the ground. Those icicle-looking formations take centuries to form. They use water that's slowly dripping through the mineral-filled ground. Compared to those other limestone caves, Wind Cave is pretty dry. You'll only find a handful of stalactites and stalagmites there. Instead, its passageways are lined with different kinds of mineral formations. Frostwork, popcorn, and boxwork. Frostwork looks like pale crystal snowflakes protruding out in little tufts and spines. It reminds me a little bit of those clusters of coral you might see underwater in the ocean. The most delicious sounding formation, popcorn, looks a little like bumpy styrofoam bubbles that are sort of growing out of each other and out of the walls. The most unique formation, however, is boxwork. In fact, 95% of the entire world's known boxwork is in this cave. And it is everywhere. It kind of looks like the stringy insides of a pumpkin, or maybe a close-up picture of a spiderweb. I took one of the cave tours with a ranger named Earl, and he explained how boxwork is formed.
The limestone that we're in, it's really old. We're talking Mississippian era in geologic time, 320, 350 million years old, older than the dinosaurs. And when this limestone was really young, it was flat. And above us, there were no prairies, there were no hills, it was all a sea. That sea trickled down into the cracks in the limestone, and it brought with it a bunch of different minerals, but most importantly for the boxwork over there, and also for things like frostwork. it brought with it a mineral called calcite. And that calcite got down into the cracks and hardened over a very, very long period of time. Now, most limestone caves form because of a liquid called carbonic acid, and this cave is no different in that regard. These caverns filled up with carbonic acid, and that acid dissolved away the ceilings, the walls, and the floors. Now, carbonic acid sounds pretty nasty, but it's really just soda pop. Most of us drink it almost every day. Soda pop, seltzer water, CO2 and water. It's the basic acid that forms a lot of limestone caves. But what happened in here that's different from a lot of caves is as it dissolved away those walls and ceilings and floors, it left exposed that mineral crack filling, the thing we call boxwork, the thing that had been put there so long before, because it's harder than the limestone. And so it's sort of like if you built your home out of sugar bricks, but you used brick mortar to hold it all together. What would happen when it rained? Yeah, you're laughing. What would happen? Yeah, but what would be left behind?
The mortar.
Yeah, the mortar, exactly. The mortar skeleton of the sugar that's gone. And that's all boxwork is, that webbing. It's just the calcite skeleton of the limestone that's no longer there.
Boxwork and popcorn frostwork leave distinctive patterns on all the limestone surfaces at Wind Cave. But when you're the first one to explore a cave, remember, you can't see any of it. Without a flashlight or a headlamp, you can't even see an inch in front of your face. It is pitch black. When a caver discovers a new room or chamber, sometimes they can't even see where the walls are, even with a flashlight. For cavers like Mark Ohms, getting an accurate map of what a cave looks like is critical to exploration. And with the help of technology, that's becoming a little bit easier.
Well, nowadays, with some of the newest technology, we can have these laser things come in, and they just shoot dots everywhere. And every time it shoots a laser someplace, it takes an exact distance, you know, basically a compass reading, an inclination, so it knows exact where it is. And because of that, we can just get insanely accurate 3D representations of, you know, the cave rooms and stuff. The downside of it, well, besides it being expensive equipment, is that, you know, it takes a long time, you know. So doing the entire cave under that is not going to happen, you know, anytime soon.
So is that not something you would bring in on an initial phase of exploration?
Yeah, that's certainly correct. You know, we'll still use, you know, the old technology for now. And then if we deem, you know, it's a really large room we want to get a good representation of or something like that, we'll kind of pick and choose, you know, where we want to do the more in-depth stuff.
For now, the easiest and quickest way to get a picture of what a cave looks like is to have someone on your team sketch the room. So if you're an artist who doesn't mind crawling into tight spaces in near total darkness, I think I have the perfect job for you.
Sketching in a cave is certainly an art, and not everyone can do it. So you got to have a good sketcher on your team. So if you can sketch well, you get invited on a lot of trips.
So it's a pretty safe bet that Mark is going to have a really good sketcher on his team as he explores the depths of Persistence Cave.
The thrill of exploration for cavers, you know, is finding that next big room, the next passage. We want to see blackness. That's what we're looking for. Blackness that goes on forever. You know, we don't want to find the end of the cave, you know. That means we're done. That's a letdown. So, you know, so we're looking for that new passage and that new thrill. And when you get into something and you look around and you don't see any footprints, you know, you're the first person here. And you know this cave's been here for millions of years. And you look across a room and, you know, a crystal sparkles. And you realize in the million years that crystal's been there, it's never, ever, ever sparkled before because it's never had light on it before until your headlight, you know, made it sparkle. And that's pretty cool. So, I mean, there's not many places on this earth that you can have that thrill of exploration, you know. I mean, it's been a long time since astronauts have even felt that, you know. Until we land on Mars, you know, that's it. So, you know, cavers, you know, right here in your own backyard can, you know, have that thrill of exploration and being the first person someplace.
I never thought of being in a cave like space exploration, but he is totally right. Carter, were there ever times in Yosemite where you felt like you were on another planet?
Yes. It was in the spider caves near Yosemite Falls, and it was like cramped spaces. It felt like on another planet because there was like no one in there, and you saw spider webs in the cave.
That's it for this episode of Brains On. You can check out the rest of our series on the national parks at our website, brainson.org, or wherever you usually listen. We've got more on the national parks coming up, so keep listening.
Brains On is produced by Mark Sanchez, Sandon Taunton, and Molly Bloom.
Many thanks to Leslie Watley, Lauren D., and Corey Schreppel.
You can see photos of Wind Cave National Park on our Instagram.
We're at brains_on.
And that's our Twitter handle, too.
You can also keep up with us on Facebook or by subscribing to our newsletter. You can do that at brainson.org.
Thanks for listening.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.